I still carried on trading as a plumber. I was still working, functioning. I was carrying half a bottle of brandy in my bag, just to top up to keep me going, and a couple of packets in my pocket, just to use whenever I want.
Keeps you kind of sober enough just to work then, doesn't it? If you're
using. It kept me enough. I mean, there was times on a building site where I had to be walked off because I overdone it, not realising, because I was going through something emotional and I didn't understand, you know.
Yeah.
And the word I used to use all the time, it's okay, I've got this. I never had it.
I hear you on
that. Yeah, it was killing me slowly.
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. Today, I have the pleasure of sitting down with Vinny. Vinny's an upstanding member of the recovery circles and helps a lot of people globally. He started out in a very conservative family in London, very strong on religion, rebelled against it, become involved in guns and drugs and all sorts of scenarios, and has turned his life around today. So in some of these episodes, there will be discussions of alcohol misuse, drugs, sexual abuse, suicide, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Hi, Vinny. Thanks for coming on. This is Powerful. Looking forward to our conversation. I'm going to start with, where are you from, mate, in the UK, and how was your upbringing?
I'm from Northwest London, Northwest 10, and I was brought up in Harlesden, Stonebridge Estate, Church Road, and upbringing was very religious.
Was it?
Yeah.
What religion?
Hinduism.
Oh, okay. Which has got a nice spiritual thread, no?
Which now I understand it has, but before I didn't.
How, when you didn't understand, how was that as growing up with?
Getting forced to go to the temple, not knowing what the temple's about, forced to be vegan, where everyone else was doing whatever they wanted to do, and, you know, being sent to a Gujarati school to learn the language, which I didn't want to learn, and getting forced to do things which I did not want to do.
So it doesn't sound like a very harmonious upbringing.
Yeah, if you didn't do it, you got a slap. And it was the same case with my brothers, my two brothers.
What age was it that you noticed that? Is it because you felt that you was different, doing different things from everyone else on the estate and in the area of Harlesden? Or?
Yeah, everybody was out doing whatever they had to do, and they had the freedom, and a bit of freedom was probably taken off us at an early age. We still got the chance to go out on the streets and play, but it was all of the time on a Saturday afternoon we had to stop doing what we had to do and head to the temple, do some prayers, and then take us into the school, which didn't end well.
Did it start well?
It started well. You know, I enjoyed the grounds in Hare Krishna Temple in Watford. You know, he enjoyed all the aspects of going out in the fields and playing around and being a kid.
What age was this, Vinny, from when you went to the temple to when you stopped going?
Probably about the age of about 6, 7, 8. I can't actually tell you what age it was. It was a long time ago.
Yeah. Not as long as my time, because I think I'm older than you. But why did you start at 6? Is that a normal thing to start at an age, or do people start before or after?
I think it was to do with more a lot of other people in the community was doing it. And our family was more community-based, as, you know, the structure around the Asian side was stick with your own.
Yeah.
And whatever they're doing, let's do that, you know. And
when you say Asian side, are you mixed or are you?
No, just on our upbringing, on the Hinduism side.
Yeah.
They stuck with themselves.
Yeah.
Stuck. Community was tight-knit community.
Which is a good side to it as well, right?
Which is a good side to it. But then you see the aspects of what's going on in other families, or you see other friends doing other things, and you try and mingle, don't you?
Yeah. So as a youngster, was that, did you feel then that you was being pulled away from a bigger environment that you wanted to belong to?
Yeah. I mean, I'm just pulled away from things all the time, and I'm seeing, you know, other Asian kids doing different things, and I'm thinking, why do I have to do this? You know, and getting resentful quite early to the family. I remember one conversation with my mum and dad, and I'm yelling at them saying, if you want us to be this person or this way, why don't you just take us back to India?
And how was that received?
Not good. Slap.
Yeah. So it was quite harsh, your parents. Was that normal for that environment, or do you think that you had quite harsh parents because they was probably trying to contain you in
trying to protect us. And do I think it's harsh? Now I do. When I'm more understanding, I thought it was harsh, but I don't think they knew it was harsh.
Yeah.
Or what was doing, it was going to be doing to us in the end.
So how long did you go to the school for?
Not long, maybe 1 or 2 years.
Okay.
And then every time they dropped me, I used to jump over the back fence.
So you was escaping? Escape,
and the plan was to go there to escape, and whoever can get the easiest escape route.
And how old were you when you was trying to literally escape from that?
Probably about 9.
That was young to rebel then, right?
Yeah.
Were your siblings rebelling as well, or was it just you?
Kind of. They were. It's hard to remember
exactly
what went on, but all we know about, there was a security guard trying to capture kids who escaped.
It sounds quite terrible.
And never caught me. So I was very good at getting away.
You were fast.
Oh, yeah, I was fast. Yeah, and I'm good at hiding.
Was there alcohol and stuff like that in your upbringing?
Yeah, there was alcohol. My dad was used to always have a bottle of whiskey in one of the cupboards and hide it away. And it was alcohol. I do remember the first clip of alcohol when I got it. That was 1980, May the 10th. And I still remember the day.
Wow. Why was it so significant?
Yeah, because it was Arsenal West Ham final. Yeah, and that's the day I turned into a West Ham supporter.
I had no idea you was a West Ham supporter.
Yeah, I'm a West Ham supporter, but don't yell it out.
Just whisper it, don't worry, it's just us. How did that go down for, like, NW10?
I think it was the choice. I mean, I remember where I was when I was watching it, and a can of Foster's, and they gave me a can of Foster's just to try. I took a couple of sips, then they put it down, and I remember picking it back up again.
Who's they, mate?
Was that neighbours.
Oh, okay.
Mm. Yeah,
watching this game?
Yeah, watching the game.
How old were you then?
I was 7.
7?
Yeah.
Okay, that was early.
Mm.
Did you know or understand at an early age that maybe drink wasn't a good thing, or was it a good thing in your environment?
I didn't know. I didn't understand. I just thought they're doing it leisurely, laughing their heads off, drinking away, and just thought it was just a normal. I don't know exactly. I mean, the neighbours did have a lot of domestics, and we heard a lot of stuff go on. And now I know why it was alcohol fueled. But at that time, young, I ain't got Scooby-Doo.
We had the same neighbours. We must have been on the other side of each other. Our neighbours, blessed, they was really lovely. And I'm still really good friends with the daughter. But there was lots of drinking going on, lots of loud arguments and stuff like that, and dogs flying out the window and things. And we loved them because they were such lovely people. But when alcohol got involved, it always went the wrong way. So I was aware that there was stuff with alcohol that wasn't good, but I didn't know to the depths, obviously, now what that was. Did you go back to school? So after 9, you was bunking off and moving away.
But I was doing normal school at that time, and the Saturday school started fading away. Because they lost control a little bit.
Yeah.
And we just refused to go. There were stages in our life where we just went, no, I ain't doing it.
And how was normal school then like?
Normal school up to that age was okay-ish. My family, my mum and dad never got involved with, you know, coming into school to parents' evenings. I'll probably be the only kid without having a parent coming in. So I used to get confused about that bit. You know, everybody brings their mums and dads, and I just don't go.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't understand English.
Right. Fair, yeah, they probably felt.
Yeah, it felt difficult.
Did you go school till 16? Did you study anything after?
No. No, I started drifting in and out of school at the age of 13 until I found that there was a different way of making money. So I did go to schools, but they're not my schools, which I was meant to go to. I was sitting in classrooms, which I didn't belong to that school. And then in those days, they didn't have a clue.
So literally I used to slip into another school. What about the uniform?
Yeah. Because there's no uniform at that time.
Right.
You know, and I used to just have a laugh with every pupil and just be the clown.
Yeah.
And then I'd cause havoc, basically, and then leave.
Do you think that was a kind of, in hindsight, a rebellion that you didn't get the attention from your parents to go into your school? So you kind of just dismissed it as something that you don't want to do?
Yeah, I think so. And not only that, I think I just wanted to be liked.
Yeah.
To one stage. And if it meant me being a bit of a prat and giving everyone a laugh, not a people pleasing or kid pleasing, whatever you want to call it, but just
it's kind
that
of getting,
sense of belonging.
Yeah.
You know,
it's belonging getting that every kid needs attention.
Yeah.
Negative or positive, we all need that as young people, don't we? I guess we sort that out in any way we can. Was you involved in drinking drugs in your teenage years when you were going to school?
Yeah, I was up and running at the age of 13, 14.
Okay. For those who don't know what up and running means in another country, what does that mean?
Yeah, up and running is in bottles of Thunderbirds and MD-2020 and smoking a spliff here and there.
Nothing heavy.
Nothing heavy, and then special brew and, you know, getting the cans, which everybody, like, you know, the guys, you know, the other guys in the actual area drinking cans in black bags and clowning around. And I became a part of.
So that was your community, really?
My community was a lot of people who did a lot of wrong things. And I see a lot of things go on at a young age.
Yeah.
And I got involved in it. And I felt a part of, like a different family.
Yeah. Did you distance yourself from your parents then, or was it just like two lives, like living with the guys? And
yeah, I distanced myself from the family because when we moved from Northwest London, we moved to Wilsdon Green. And when we first got a place, they gave me the room right at the back, the box room, the tiniest room, and that was my room. So I decided to put a lock on it, digital lock. So they didn't know if I was there or not. So I can go and do what I want. And there was a drain pipe on the side and out the window. So they didn't want to have a clue if I was in there or not.
Yeah.
And I just took to the streets.
And how was that for them? Did they just give up?
They gave up. Yeah, they gave up quite early because they couldn't control it.
No. How was sometimes when you talk about alcohol to people that they do it to fit in, but some people will drink it and think, this is my superpower now, I'm going to take this because I feel stronger, better, I don't care. Yeah. How did it affect you early on?
Taking that suppressed a lot of stuff early on. A lot of going through puberty, no father figure around. It adjusted the way I thought straight away. And it's like a superpower, isn't it? You know, you can go and do what you want. The ego comes out to play. And no one can touch you.
It takes away all the inhibitions, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course
about
it does.
Not caring. So it's such a powerful drug. And you know, after, depends on the person, but you can have a couple of glasses of scotch or something and just that's it. It's almost like you've been to the gym, you don't care.
Who gives?
And in fact, I think if you've got something missing in your life, you push it really hard, don't you? I did anyway. I really pushed stuff and done things I would never really do. One thing was to keep people away from me who I felt intimidated by. I'd do something even crazier. So they was like, hang on a minute, there's something wrong with him. We'll leave him alone. And the other one was to try and belong.
Yeah. I mean, with alcohol and a cocktail of drugs at an early age, I found my place.
What was your mindset at the time? Because mine, when I was that young, I just, I think about 13, I found boxing as well. And I just, I don't know, I feel like I was on the run in the sense I just wanted to do things that gave me adrenaline or praise or crazy things.
Yeah.
But boxing at the time actually probably straightened me out a little bit, because I realised that if you want to be good and not get hurt, you've got to train hard. And I really liked that discipline. How was your mindset at 13?
Stealing. Stealing gave me a buzz.
A lot of people say that.
Yeah, and it gave me a very big, like a lot of heat inside me when I got away with things. And yeah. I got a big kick out of it. And the bigger the kick, the bigger the hit, the way I see it. So the bigger thing I've done, and I've done a lot.
Do you mind going into that? Like what kind of things you were stealing, or you don't have to?
Well, the stealing was breaking into places, to gain quick money.
Yeah.
You know, I watched enough gangster movies to know that this is the way to be. And I've been surrounded by people who are very naughty. So I just thought it would be a nice environment to be around. And unless I say a product of your own environment, that environment was quite in depth of what they were up to. And I just wanted to be a big part of it. But the only way to be a big part of it is to be the bigger thief.
Yeah.
And I accomplished that in loads of directions.
Yeah.
And half the stuff which did go on, they didn't know it was me. So I was a hidden force behind it.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of mischief going on.
What were you guys doing? I know it sounds silly, but what were you guys doing with the money? Because a lot of people I know never really invested money. They just spent it on booze and parties. And
I partied like it was going out of fashion. So even there, when you were allowed in the pubs at that time, you know, I'd be in there and I'd always have money. And they say, "Well, you get the money from?" I went, "Don't worry." It's, you know, and then going to clubs and stuff like that.
So you left, you left school, went straight into earning money that way.
Yeah.
And then just partied. And
just partied, you know, especially kitchen parties. Great for kitchen parties, isn't it? Don't realise when the sun's coming up and go, "Oh my God."
Yeah. So did you have any career or any actual straight work?
No. What happened is my family sat me down and said that, you know, I have to get some sort of qualification and, you know, go into a scheme of some sort.
When was this, Philip?
This was at the age of 17. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I remember going to the YTS and they had like electrician, bricklayer and all that.
That was the scheme that was, if I remember, it was £12 a week,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, it was criminal, yeah. £12 a week. God damn, I made that so quickly. But the only space at that time was a plumber. So I chose plumbing. And I was doing all right with it, kept with it, until you get to the dreaded lunchtime when the pub's open. Never went back. So I carried on doing the plumbing. I managed to get myself a trade. I got somebody who trained me. They put me into a placement, but even that involved drinking. So the drinking environment and the building game is quite major factor.
Yeah.
And the drugs.
So you actually did focus on doing it though properly as well?
Yeah, I focused on going to college, trying to get a qualification, but I just dropped out of college because you had to go to college and study, and I'm not a studying type of person. I'm hands-on. And I carried on working on building sites, getting trained up, and was self-taught.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. And how did your... Because you said I did some construction years ago as well, and two of the guys I worked with, different guy, but two of the guys I worked with were literally lunchtime, would do 10 pints and go back. I have no idea how they worked. I really don't. They probably took drugs at the time.
Yeah.
And then I did a short stint with a neighbour doing suspended ceilings, and I worked with this guy who, I've shared this before, who was a really lovely fella, but he was always acting a bit weird and he smelt strange. And one day I went to creep up the side of his van and knock on just to make him jump, and he was injecting with a bath, rope cord around his arm, and I'd never seen it before. And obviously taking heroin, and it was a weird thing because I didn't know how to react as a young guy. I was really young then. I was 16, and I was like, "How do you deal with that? What do I say something? Do I not say something?" And this carried on for a couple of months, He ended up taking his life, unfortunately. But it was a very weird thing to see, because I started to see his lies, him stealing and stuff like that. But there's definitely a lot of it. I don't know about now, but there was a lot then. Did you see that as a problem, or did you see that as a
part I remember of work? When I was training, and one lunchtime, they turned around to me and they said to me, "We're going down the pub." I know exactly what pub it was. And he said, "If you don't come down the pub and have a drink with us, you have to stay at work until 6. So I decided to go down the pub. And then it was, if you don't drink 3 pints to 4 pints, you've got to go back at work. So I drank 3 to 4 pints. I don't want to go back to work. And then it just multiplied. So, and they never went back to work, or they sent me back just to wrap up the tools and go back to pub.
It's a weird thing to say to someone, because it's almost like justifying them doing what they're doing, right?
Yeah, exactly what it was. And not only that, when they, you know, they'll come along and they'll roll up a spliff. "I'll just take a couple of lugs of that. You'd be all right with that." And I'll go, "Yeah, all right then, because I'm a part of."
Yeah. How old was you then?
17.
Do you know what? It's so tough with peer pressure. I found peer pressure really difficult. And I like, people use that word nonchalantly, but actually it's very difficult. We teach this in our Stride Foundation to the school kids. Peer pressure is really difficult because everyone wants to belong. And if you don't have a stable family, then you're going to yield to it more, to doing peer pressure. And it's amazing in hindsight how much I sacrificed of my well-being to be part of something that I didn't want to be part of anyway.
Yeah, yeah, I understand that. But now when I turn around, I look at it, I think the power of choice was taken off me, because I just wanted to be a part of.
Yeah.
Just wanted to be with a gang, or, you know, just new family, you know, when you're not getting what you're meant to be getting indoors. Well, I don't understand what you was meant to be getting indoors anyway, because the understanding had gone for me a long time ago. But I do realise one thing is, when I was in school and, you know, people started staying away from me, it was due to my using and my behaviour pattern. And, you know, people just kept their distance from me.
Was that because you got scary and intimidated, or you just...
Because I was a very angry kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was a very angry person, because I just hated everything, you know, and I'll just pick on people and just like bully. But, you know, I got bullied when I was a little bit younger, and then I just took it out on everybody else as the superhero power came into it. And I thought, I can do the same thing to other people.
It's sad, isn't it? Because hurt people hurt, and now in recovery, we can change all that, but early on in life, it's really difficult. If someone's being hurt inside the home or outside the home, what do you do with that? It just rebounds into anger, to taking some form of control back, because you lose all your control, don't you? It's quite intimidating. I always said that I was never bullied. I was intimidated by, I think it was about 8 fellas at my school, and even on the first day when they came in, someone spat on me and they all stood there, and I was like, do you take one of them out? Do you go for it? Do you not go for it? And that bothered me for a long time, because I didn't walk into school thinking this is going to be great. I walked into school saying, who's going to come where? Yeah. And I looked after myself in the end, but for a number of years, it was not a nice feeling.
I came across the same situation, and I was petrified of someone. And until one day, and I went, I'm not having it. I'm not having it anymore. This is it. I'm done. Because I've seen my brothers beat up by a load of skinheads at a young age. So that anger was already there. And when I flipped, I remember having that fight with him. And, you know, I didn't know when to stop, because I was very angry. And then from there, I got up and I went, that's it. No one's going to touch me ever again.
Yeah.
And I behaved like that for a number of years. Well, a long time.
Yeah. And I won't say it's standard, but that's what happens. You become the aggressor and the tough guy, because actually it's anger's an interesting mask, isn't it? It stops all the pain. It stops all the pain right there. And you can see it in people when they glaze over and they're angry. You're like, okay, I better walk away. It's amazing. It's a protection thing, but unfortunately it goes a bit further, doesn't it? For especially
for frustration as well.
Yeah.
Frustration with the environment you're in. Don't know what way to behave.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of that's been coming up recently.
How sober are you now, mate?
I am 2,500 days in.
Not you counting.
No, that's, it was 2,501 days today.
Brilliant.
Yeah,
that's incredible.
Which is an absolute miracle.
Yeah, it's lovely, mate. And I know you do a lot in the recovery environment. What was it that actually brought you in? So from that part, there's a lot. How old are you now?
I'll be 51 this year.
Are you really?
Yeah.
Tell me what face cream you're using. Definitely need it. I didn't know you was 51 this year. Wow.
Yeah, see, you had a Yellow Pages paper around and I had a normal one.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I had double lots. Like that. So when did you come in? You was 40?
44.
Wow.
Yeah.
So between early ages we're talking about, how did that progress? Because you moved from Northwest London, you stayed there?
Yeah, I moved from Northwest London and I'd done the geographical. I drifted everywhere because of the
crime. As in around London or in the country?
Around London.
Yeah.
Everywhere I went, it was meant to be a change.
And, so you're trying to escape from stuff.
And the progressive side of it kept on following me. Start off a little bit light, using a bit of lager shandies, this and that. Think I've got it. And then all hell break loose. And then I have to move again.
So those who don't know, when you say move away from it, it's obviously the drink and the drugs catching up again. So there was times, when did you realise that I think I've got a problem here? Or did you not realise that? Because some people have a stark day where they're like, oh, I've got a problem, I've got to sort it out, but can't or don't. And some people don't realise, they think it's their environment or someone else's issue.
At the age of, I share this freely now and I'll be open. At the age of 19, I put a gun in my mouth. Well, crying my eyes out. I was using, couldn't stop using. And I wanted to pull the trigger due to the fact that, which I own now, is sexual abuse as a child. And it affected me. And because I was, I was looked up to in different points of the criminal stuff I did. And I couldn't talk about the damage it done to me.
Yeah.
And there's one of the triggers which I used to have was, why did they do that to me? And, pull me, pull me, pull me. And then look for the answer at the bottom of the bottle or the packet.
Yeah.
And the answer never came.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, mate. It's a lot of us who's had stuff like that happen. And it causes so much damage. It does cause so much damage. And I'm going to take a break for a sec. Just take a minute, guys. Do you want tissue, Vinny? Go on, mate. You all right? Thanks, mate. I'm glad you never pulled the trigger. What happened after that, mate? How did you move forward after that day? Because it's quite a heavy day.
How did I move on from that? I turned into a Tasmanian devil. I never recovered.
Right.
Everything I did, everything I built up, I crumbled down quite quick. Every relationship I had ended because of my addiction.
Yeah.
And I didn't see a way out.
And that, so you carried on quite some time though, to 44.
Yeah, I carried it.
Yeah. So what did you do? Did you do any work still, or did you stay in the criminal?
No, I still carried on trading as a plumber. I was still working, functioning. I was carrying half a bottle of brandy in my bag, just a top up to keep me going.
Yeah.
And a couple of packets in my pocket. Just to use whenever I want. And
keeps you kind of sober enough just to work then, doesn't it? If you're
using. It kept me enough. I mean, there was times on a building site where I had to be walked off because I overdone it, not realising, because I was going through something emotional and I didn't understand, you know.
Yeah.
And the word I used to use all the time, it's okay, I've got this. I never had it.
I know.
Yeah, it was killing me slowly.
Yeah. That's what people don't understand. Some people think, well, it's your fault. Government does this. It's your fault. If you don't drink, you'll be okay. If you don't use, you're okay. But don't understand how addiction's progressive. Because early on, it becomes our medicine, doesn't it? It's our painkiller, our safeguard. And but I just, once you cross that line, it gets really painful, doesn't it? What was the final thing that brought you in, mate, at the sprightly age of 44?
The final thing which brought me in, I'll rewind it a little bit, is 2004. That was exactly 20 years ago. October the 16th, I was brought back to life 3 times. I overdosed. I was rushed into hospital. And they found 2 unknown traces in my bloodstream. They didn't know what I was doing. You know, family was called in to say bye. And I was given another opportunity in life.
What did you OD on?
I was using a number of factors of drugs.
Yeah.
But the immune system was shutting down slowly and I could feel it. And I knew what I was doing to myself. That's after my first wife left me and the child.
Yeah.
So that gave me the green light. And, you know, I was chewing ecstasy pills in the morning for breakfast, you know, using them to function. And the body only took so much. And, I bounced back from that. So, and then,
after they resuscitated or brought you back the last time, did you think, okay, I've got to change what I'm doing, things have to go? And what happened in that process?
I behaved for 6 weeks. Yeah, so they had to give me steroids and all the other bits because my body just shrunk and, you know, and I said to myself, I won't use. And I was up and running. It didn't help with the friends I had that came over to the hospital to visit me with bags of beer and gear.
Yeah.
But, you know, I didn't use it at that time. But 6 weeks after coming out of hospital, it progressed again. And this time it was going to lead to disaster. In the meantime, I've lost a number of people through addiction. And I just thought I was going to go out that way. I had a plan.
Just used till you die, basically.
Yeah, I mean, there's many a times I used to an extent where I'll go to sleep and I'll put my arms in dying position. So when they pick up the body in the morning, they don't have to move my arms and I'll wake up the next day and I'll do it again.
So that's really sad when there was times when I didn't want to die, but I didn't want to wake up. I used to think about usually a car. I love cars and bikes. I used to think about there's a particular bridge when I was in England on the A127. I thought if I go over there long enough, fast enough, and I get cans of fuel, I'll just open all the cans of fuel. And as the car takes off, I'll just light it.
Yeah.
And then everyone will feel sorry for me finally, or they'll know what I've been through.
Yeah.
And I used to think about it all the time. It's sad, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I used to go to the Central Line and have it in my head that I want to throw myself in front of the train.
Yeah.
I'll get my sights up for that. And I look up the screen, it says train delayed. And I go, what the hell? I've all been psyched up about this and now the train ain't coming. So there was all the signs out there that it weren't my time. It weren't my time.
How do you feel now? Because you're way into recovery. You do a lot for a lot of people. You do, clearly do a lot of work for yourself, on yourself. How does it feel to look back at Vinny back then?
Heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Absolutely heartbreaking. Knowing that there was a way out and I didn't know, you know. I mean, I didn't know about recovery. And the things I did watch on TV, I do remember going, oh my God, why are these guys, man up, admitting you're an alcoholic or an addict. You, what's wrong with you? You should have control. I've got control. And you're judgmental.
But that's the thing, though. You don't, especially as guys, I can only speak as a guy, that it's like in Fight Club when you saw Meatloaf in the rooms talking about, I used to look at it thinking, what is that? What? Why would you do that? And not understand that that's not a program, that's just a meeting place. So when you came in finally after all of that, how did you come into a 12-step program? What did you do to try and get better? Did you know you were trying to get better?
My my end game, which I share freely, is December the 16th, 2017. And that was the crunch day. Where I blacked out for 3 months of 2017, where I was using so much. I ended up having a heart attack as well in the November 2017. My wife has come home after working in a club. She's told me that I've got problems and I need help. I need to get into treatment. And I said to her, I said, I don't need you. I don't need your family. I don't need anyone. And I picked up a knife. And when I picked up the knife, I went to slice my throat. And the kids came running in and the wife knocked the knife out of my hand. And I picked up and I threw it and I ended up chopping my missus. That's when you know that.
Yeah.
That was it. I mean, I could have killed her. You know, the mother of my three children could have killed her. And then the police came and it's the first time when I've been arrested, I actually put my hands in front and said, I need help. There was nothing left of me. There was no soul left. There was nothing in the eyes. The lights were on, but no one was at home. That's the way I see it. And that's where my journey began. Because that was my second family, which I destroyed.
Yeah.
It does. That's what it does to you, isn't it?
Destroys everything.
Destroys everything around you. And you think you can piece it back together. But sometimes you've lost all trust and everything else which is around you, you know. And the put an injunction out of me and I couldn't come anywhere near them, so that broke my heart, because that was Christmas 2017. And decided, well, I didn't decide, and I, again, I'll be truthful with this, you know, I did, my sister decided that I should go into treatment. And the magic words was, if you don't go into treatment and sort yourself out, I'll never ever speak to you again.
Were you close to your sister?
I'm very close to my sister. And I finally listened to her. But even that, I had a motive. If I go there, they could probably teach me how to use like a...
fine slum, gentleman.
And, like a, and drink like a gentleman. Yeah. And everybody can see I'm trying to do something for my addiction. But it didn't plan out that way. Because I went into treatment and... things progressed. There was other people like me.
When, just quickly, did you, when you got arrested, did they, could they charge you of anything, or was it okay to go into treatment as part of?
What they did, they got me assessed by the doctors, and I remember the words came out my mouth, and they said, if we release you, what are you going to do? I said, either kill myself or kill the first person I see.
Yeah.
They let me calm down, and then, they took me up to court, and my sister came up to court, and she took in charge, saying that, you know, booked into, I'm going to go into treatment, I'm going to get the help, and they put me on bail.
Wow.
But, of course, domestic violence, even if the partner doesn't want to pursue it, CPS do, especially when I've got previous, and I've done a lot of previous, and they... And I was blessed because I didn't get done for the big one. And, you know, I was given another opportunity. And, you know, I took it.
When you went into treatment, although you had a bit of an agenda, was you grateful to your sister for that? And was you grateful in general to have that break away from addiction itself and realising what it's caused?
Yeah, I think mixing and relating to other people in the same situation, yeah, I've got that connection very quick. you know, and the support I got was not from, and I'll say it, is from not from counsellors or therapists who studied it. It's people who lived it. Mm. That's what I got from. But people who lived it, not studied it, and been in my head. And I could relate more to the people like that than the other people.
I think that's from, I think it's amazing because I, when I was in treatment, when I first went to a meeting, it was on a Sunday morning after 3 days of being out, and I put a nice jacket on, shirt, bless me, went there, and I was asking for where the doctors are, where's the people that know what, you know, how to help me. I had no idea what it was about. I really didn't. When I realised after, I went into treatment after, and I walked around the grounds with this guy who was brought in by armed guard, and he was a big, he was a pit bull of a dude, and he kept staring at me in the room, and I thought, oh God, you know, I don't know what it was, but I kept staring back, thinking, I hope nothing happens. And we went for a walk one day, and he said something, and I just said, listen, I'll be honest with you, I said, I'm absolutely terrified of you. I said, I can fight because I used to be a boxer, but that's not my thing. And I find you really, really intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, I find you intimidating. I went, oh, no way. And when he said that, I said something else. Then he said something. And then we really opened up about stuff. For the first time in my life, I thought, because he reminded me of my dad in a way. He's quite a big old school stocky guy. And by the time we'd done the circuit of walking around, we'd shared more in that 10 minutes than I'd shared in my whole life or to the therapist and stuff. And I realised at that point, the power of sharing with someone who's not going to use that against you. And I started to realise what a fellowship is and understand that actually in recovery, it's about belonging. You just want a community. And that's where I found mine. Is that what happened to you?
In that sense? Yeah, I found out I could get honest, finally, about emotion, finally honest about emotion and how I was feeling,
yeah.
You know, rather than compressing it with substance, you know. And then when that emotion came out, and I remember in the treatment centre in the mornings when you had the meeting in the morning, and you always had to pick an emotion from a chart. I went, what are these idiots talking about? All these ones which are up there, and I'm like, and I used to use the F word. I'm just fucked, you know? And because I use that word all the time, because no, that's not an emotion. I went, that's my emotion. And I've had that for a long time. So this is my emotion for today. Mm. I'm not sure what's going to happen tomorrow. And in the end, I think 4 or 5 days into it, I picked sad. And I broke down.
Wow.
Because I was still trying to be that person.
Yeah.
I'd be all right, everything would be sweet, but it wasn't.
It's very brave, isn't it? Because it's we're taught in society that you're, as men anyway, that you're kind of stupid if you have emotions. You shouldn't have emotions. People take advantage, you're weak. But when I first learned about them, because I had all I had was anger and then probably feeling sorry for myself and not much in between. When you allow yourself to feel an emotion in a safe place, it's really powerful because it takes away all the illusion that you have to have this protective side. Doesn't mean you're weaker, doesn't mean you're physically weak or mentally weak. Actually, in my understanding, it makes me stronger because I become more of a whole person. How did you work through the rest of the list?
I just used to rewind my life, and I used to turn around and something happened, it was always man up, grow some balls, what's up with you? There's something in the toilet ready for you underneath the tissue. There's a few beers behind there. Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
And by that time, you're up and running. So that is something when you're trying to open up to individual, another bunch of addicts, you're not going to get much joy out of it. And the biggest one was man up.
Yeah.
Man up, grow some balls. That's all I got. And in the end, it was nurtured into me that I'm not allowed to talk about exactly how I'm feeling to anyone. And it probably would come out in a drunken spree.
Yeah.
the emotion might come out and the sobbing might come out, which is alcohol fueled,
yeah.
Or, you know, drug-induced psychosis comes up, all that type of stuff. And it felt freeing. It did feel freeing to talk about an emotion which has been buried for 30 years.
Yeah.
A genuine emotion, not, you know.
And when you started to feel the emotions in the treatment centre, did you see a light at the end of the tunnel then? Did you think, actually, there may be something in this?
No.
What was you feeling then? Or thinking then, if that was the case?
What was I thinking? I think I was a little bit destroyed because I remember the wife coming to visit me and... I was going for a walk, and this is what destroyed me was, she told me she didn't love me anymore. She hated me. She wanted nothing to do with me. So, because while I was in treatment, everything came out of the wash, and people told her exactly what I did and what I was doing, and she didn't have a clue. So, you know, I've drifted away from that question a little bit. Is she searched the house. She was told to search the house by a number of people, and when she searched the house, it shocked her, because of the hidden, hidden bottles everywhere, stash, wraps everywhere, stash. And when she came to visit me, the first thing I said to her was, oh, so you found some gear. Was there anything in it? She went, yeah. I went, what'd you do with it? Did you bag it up? I could get rid of that. No, she threw it in the bin. Broke my heart.
Yeah, you hadn't changed at that point then. So what point did you change though, Vinny? Because like I said, you're a really upstanding guy in recovery. Quite a spiritual man, as I believe now. So when did you start to get traction in recovery? What was it that happened?
When I'd done a number of meetings, a few meetings I didn't adapt to. I went into one particular meeting, and obviously I still go to that meeting. I found happy people. I found happy, joyous people who actually found recovery. I'll be honest with you, I thought they were bullshitting. Really did. I did not
believe.
Because,
how can you be this happy?
I went, how can you be? You're nutty as a fruitcake. There's no way. You're telling me you're clean and, you know, they've got multiple years or even 30 days, 60 days. I'm like, I still didn't believe it, you know. And get a sponsor, all that type of stuff came into it one day at a time. And it was one thing which was drummed into my head was, you cannot use drugs and alcohol for the rest of your life. And I went, no way, no way, don't put that on me. He goes, well, why don't you just do it for today? And I was like, oh, today? Oh, well, you know, I'll give it a go. You know, I'll give it a go just for today. That's all I've got is today.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I got attracted to the friendship, the fellowship. You get a cup of tea and a biscuit and a cuddle. We're absolutely making a pig's ear of your life when you get that with a smile. It sounds crazy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But that's exactly what happens. Because you find a family of belonging. Finally, you found your people. Not the gangsters. Not the, it's not that. You found your genuine people.
Who want the same as you want, who are on a pathway to escape from that. And I think the amazing thing is that all the ego goes out the window.
Yeah.
All the big talk bravado. And there's some, you know, proper fellas and ladies in there that have done crazy stuff, but actually become incredibly kind and genuine people, right, that you can trust.
With no motive.
Yeah.
And that's the one which got me is, you know, when I finally did get a sponsor, I asked him, how much does he want for it? Because I've always paid. And he went, no. I went, well, give me your bank details of what it was going to cost me. I went, nothing, something for nothing. I went, I've never known of it. But it's genuine. It actually happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could be in your darkest day and you could reach out and somebody will be there for you. But if you go to your family, you get a bit of a headache. Well, I do anyway. Yeah. So, well, I'm not going to my family.
Did you go back with your wife?
I got back with my wife 9 months 9 months into my recovery, she sort of changed. And the first thing I said to her, I goes, why did you not take me back earlier? She went, oh, I didn't think that you, I didn't believe you can do it.
Oh.
Yeah, so she gave me what she calls tough love.
Which is probably not a bad thing.
Which is probably the best thing ever because it saved my life.
Yeah.
If she took me back earlier, I'd probably be up and running again.
Yeah.
But I didn't fight for her in the end. I was told I had to do it for myself. But that was a hard process to do for myself. And I did it, and I'm still doing it.
So you had two strong females that looked after you and loved you. Which you probably didn't recognise before, maybe.
Mm, which I didn't recognise.
So isn't it amazing? You're in recovery. You got a family outside of your family. You got your family now that love you. Well, sister and you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had a holiday with her this year.
How was that?
Amazing. It really was amazing. Emotional.
Yeah.
Considering she thought she was going to bury me.
Yeah.
And now I've got on holiday with her. And I was dreading it as well. Because I was thinking, oh, here we go. Bickering this, bickering that. And it was so smooth. It was just like the universe was protecting us.
Yeah.
Or somebody was protecting us all the way. And it was it's an amazing feeling to have. To have that freedom from where you was to where you are now is, sometimes I look in the mirror, I'm an emotional person, you know, and I sit there and I go, how has this really actually happened? You know, I live an amazing life now. And, the wreckage of my past and all my experience is benefiting others.
Yeah.
You know, I have a purpose. I remember going out for lunch with my sister good few months ago, and she's waiting. You wasted 30 years of your life. And I went, I don't think I wasted it now because I'm helping other people. So my experiences benefit other people. And I'm not qualified for this. I've lived it, you know, and living it and being support, not giving out sympathy. I don't give out sympathy. If somebody rings me for sympathy, I just don't give it. It's because that was one of the part of the things was, you know, people used to give me sympathy. Oh, it'd be all right, don't worry about it, it'd be fine, this and that. But it was never going to be fine. Work, inside job, I call it. Mm. Had to be done, and it's getting done every day.
Do you know what's amazing? When you think, listening to you, it's really, I love your honesty, mate. It's for someone who used to be in the criminal world on drugs, obviously had guns at hand, to someone that now looks in the mirror and doesn't, you know, who cares about other people and knows not to give sympathy because that's the wrong thing, but give them a tough love probably and helping them out. It's amazing, right?
Yeah, I mean, the soul is happy.
Mm.
It's a happy soul. You know, I've got my teeth done and, you know, just like I'm walking around bouncing around, you know, just with happiness. And somebody said to me the other day was, you're so irritating. I went, what do you mean? He goes, you're so happy all the time. And I went, because this morning I woke up and I breathe oxygen. I open up my eyes and I'm grateful to be grateful. Everything else is a bonus. And I believe that everything else is a bonus as long as I keep doing the right thing. And I do live an honest, honest life now. Yeah. So honest, I got to Newbury Park. I still didn't want to pay for parking. I had to pay for parking. £7.20. It's criminal.
But this is really important for people to hear, right, that may be wondering what recovery is or how to come in or how to stop using. But not only that, you've transformed unbelievable amounts of pain into now loving yourself enough to help other people. That's a miracle, because there's that old saying of leopard doesn't change its spots or can't even. Yeah. And I know that's completely not true for myself, and I can see that for you. It's incredible. Last question, mate. If someone's listening to our podcast, no matter what country they're in, where they are, and they're in that place where they just are in bits, what would you advise them to do?
I always say this. It's not a miracle that you're still alive. You're blessed to be alive. And if you're sitting in that pain, you think there's not a way out. One door shuts, another door opens. Allow that other door to open. Open yourself up to recovery. Get honest in all your affairs. And you can live that life beyond your wildest dreams. And, you know, I've seen so many miracles in a good few years. But, you know, the biggest miracle I saw was, you know, a lady getting her daughter back, finally. You know, she signed her daughter off and then she got her back after a period of time in sobriety. And these miracles are occurring daily. I've seen some families put back together, which has just been lovely to be a part of. But I'm pure recovery. Yeah. I don't deal with families. I just deal with the recovering addict.
Yeah.
And, you know, help and support wherever I can. You know, and I'm, you know, sponsoring and still doing like 5 to 6 meetings a week. Recovery has taken over my life, but I owe my life to recovery.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm doing that, you know, who would believe I'd be doing that worldwide, which has been amazing. You know, so the gift is there. And I think we are gifted.
Yeah.
And the spiritual side, yeah. I go a lot along the lines of the spiritual sides with spiritual numbers and robins and butterflies and signs from the universe, not signs from Vinny. These are guiding notes of which we've probably missed in the cloud.
Mm.
But I see them all the time and it's amazing what... There's another power source here at work. We don't know what it is, but I love it.
Thank you, Vinny. Cheers, mate.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, mate. That was amazing.
Leg's gone completely.
Cheers, mate.
Oh, right, I'll catch you.
That was amazing.
Oh, my leg's gone completely.
Is it? Yeah. That's old age.
Oh, it is. I've got that.
How old are you?
53.
Get out of here. I thought you were 60.
Thanks.
Should we get a picture done?
This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scofield.